TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
How support for Israel's violations of international law puts the U.S. on the wrong side of history. Nora Erekat. Nora Erekat is a noted Palestinian legal scholar, human rights attorney, and activist. She's an assistant professor at George Mason University and was one of the speakers at the annual conference organized by the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. She spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on March 2, 2018. The theme of the conference was The Israel Lobby and American Policy. Speakers explored the different ways in which a powerful lobby for Israel, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, influences U.S. law, our Middle East policy, and our elections. Steering the flow of donations to Israel-friendly members of Congress, they then ensure the flow of foreign aid and weapons to Israel. Nora Erekat followed Dr. Virginia Tilley. She argued in her presentation that the U.S. is supporting an apartheid state in Israel. Nora Erekat, in contrast, depicted Israel as a settler colonialist state. She said, "I want to urge us to think of this as settler colonialism first, a project that's distinct from colonization. The settler who moves into the colony is traveling with their sovereignty, with an intent to stay. There is the removal of the native with the intent to replace them with the settler." End quote. Zionist forces in 1948 expelled an estimated 750,000 Palestinians from more than 500 villages in establishing a predominantly Jewish state. During the 1967 war, Israel seized the West Bank, Syria's Golan Heights, Gaza, and the old city of Jerusalem. Gaza, under siege by Israel for more than a decade, has been described by international observers as an open-air prison for Palestinians, controlled by military checkpoints. They may not even approach the border with Israel, as the events of April 2018 show. The West Bank, in violation of international law and the International Court of Justice, has been shot through with Israeli settlements, some the size of small towns, in which more than 500,000 Jewish settlers now live and from which Palestinians are barred. Nora Erekat says Israel cannot outright annex the West Bank because it would then have to incorporate the entire population of 2.8 million Palestinians currently still living there. But if it does not annex the land and acknowledges occupation, it would be obliged by international law to give the land back to the Palestinians. And that is why, according to Nora Erekat, Israel created a new category in law and declares that this occupation is distinct and unlike any other occupation. According to Israel, Palestinians don't exist as a people, and the territories belong to no sovereign. This is not occupation by law, but an occupation by fact. Nora Erekat carefully lays out the argument in the talk you are about to hear and concludes with a deeply disturbing parallel. The United States, she says, is a settler colony. What we see going on in Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline is actually the removal of natives and taking away of their lands and obscuring the fact that they exist as a people. It is perpetuating a myth that the natives have disappeared in very similar ways that we perpetuate the myth of disappearance of Palestinians. End quote. Janet McMahon is managing editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. She introduced Noura Erekat.
Our final speaker, Noura Erekat, is a noted legal scholar, human rights attorney, and activist. She is an assistant professor at George Mason University, a co-founder and editor of Jadalia e-Zine, and an editorial committee member of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Prior to joining the George Mason faculty, she served as legal counsel for a House subcommittee, legal advocate for the Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights, and as the national grassroots organizer and legal advocate at the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, now the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Most recently, she released a pedagogical project on the Gaza Strip and Palestine, the centerpiece of which is a short multimedia documentary titled Gaza in Context, which positions Israel's wars on Gaza within a settler colonial framework. She is also the producer of the short video Black Palestinian Solidarity and is currently working on a book project tentatively titled Justice for Some, Law as Politics in the Question of Palestine. It's a great pleasure to introduce Noura Erekat.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you to all of you. I think you are very brave to come to this session, which focuses on law, which in and of itself is meant to be obscurist in order to disempower people to take their lives into their own hands, and by its very definition is indeterminate. So what we believe the law to proclaim is going to be subject to our own mediation as well as judicial interpretation. So anything on its face that the law tells us can be subject to some sort of legal controversy depending on who the lawyer is representing. So I really appreciated Dr. Tilly's presentation, but if my client were Israel, I could use the very same legal framework to come to a very different conclusion, which is why our reliance on law has to come with a great deal of skepticism and with a strategic vision. With that in mind, I want to build on what was said earlier to discuss occupation law and the way that occupation law has not failed to stem the proliferation of settlements and settlers within the West Bank and in Gaza until 2005, but instead, without occupation law, Israel could not have and could not continue to expand and entrench its settler colonial presence within the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, and frankly, throughout Mandate Palestine. So quick note on framework. Dr. Tilly walked us through apartheid and said that this would recast how we envision this to now think of it as settler colonialism. I want to urge us to think of this as settler colonialism first, a project that's distinct from colonization in that the settler who travels into the colony is traveling with their sovereignty with an intent to stay. That intent to stay in the colony and to assert their sovereignty also places an imperative to remove the native. And so that there are two processes at play. There is the removal of the native with the intent to replace them with the settler and to establish a continuous, uninterrupted, temporal, and spatial presence. And this is from Patrick Wolf's Logic of Elimination, so that the Nakba and the removal of the Palestinians isn't an event, but becomes an ongoing Nakba, as Palestinians have referred to it, but also fits in this theoretical framework. If then we begin with settler colonization as the framework, apartheid and occupation become two legal regulatory regimes that enable and fulfill those settler colonial ambitions of removal and replacement. So Dr. Tilly discussed one approach, apartheid. I'll discuss occupation. Here's the map that you may be familiar with. Obviously, Israel never defined its borders. These are the 1949 armistice lines established in March that have never been declared in order to facilitate expansion. When Israel conquered the territories in 1967, 90% of Israelis polled wanted to maintain them, mostly for religious reasons, with having an affectionate relationship to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. But that religious relationship had no political legitimacy, and therefore Israel had no basis to remain and was compelled to actually withdraw. But Israel wanted the territories, wanted to get around the law, and again, as what was mentioned, how do you get through that elevator, wanted to get around the law. It couldn't annex the territories, even if it wanted to, because of the prohibition on annexation, which comes into disrepute in the late 18th century. Up until then, territorial conquest was permitted. But it also, let's say that it didn't care about the laws we've seen in its annexation of Jerusalem and otherwise. It didn't want to annex the territory because it would have to absorb the Palestinian population, thereby disrupting a Jewish demographic majority that had been established in the aftermath of the Nakba and the removal of 800,000 Palestinian natives. So how then? And if it recognized the territory as occupied, it would have to revert the territory to its sovereign and maintain the territorial, demographic, and political status quo. So here's the problem. It wants the land, but it doesn't want the people on the land. If it annexes the land, it absorbs the population. If it doesn't annex the land and acknowledges occupation, it has to give the land back. So instead, Israel creates a new category in law and declares that this occupation is sui generis, or distinct and unlike any other category, and argues that because Jordan's annexation of the West Bank in 1950 is not recognized by anyone besides Britain and Pakistan, and Egypt is only in authority of the Gaza Strip, and Palestinians don't exist as a people, that the territories belong to no sovereign. As such, occupation law is enshrined by the Hague Regulations, the Fourth Geneva Convention, as well as customary law, cannot be triggered. There is a sovereign void. This is not occupation by law, but shall be an occupation by fact. What does that allow Israel to do? It allows it the legal right to have presence in the territories without the legal obligation to maintain the status quo ante until the reversion of sovereignty. What does that allow for Israel? It allows it to incrementally take the land under two legal fictions, the legal fiction of military necessity and the legal fiction of temporality. As far as military necessity is concerned, the idea is it is taking the land in order to create military encampments and that all of the civilian presence is temporary. Obviously, that's a contradiction on its face because you don't place civilians in a military encampment, otherwise you're using your own civilians as human shields, or it is in fact permanent. That is the first legal fiction. The second legal fiction of temporality is what Meir Shamgar, the military advocate general and then chief justice for the Israeli High Court for 2 decades, describes as temporality. It's a temporary presence of the civilians, which is indefinite, which is the opposite of permanent. Meaning that it is not permanent, but we do not have to declare an end to it, and that is the opposite of permanency, and therefore can be temporary. That is a legal fiction. But these legal fictions survive because the law in and of itself, and especially international law, lacking a hierarchical adjudication system, lacking a reliable enforcement model, becomes subject to the political will of the international community and therefore can vary by application, implementation, and interpretation as it does here. The United States is central to this interpretation. And it's central to this interpretation despite the fact that sub-administrations from the Johnson administration to the present, well, not this administration, have recognized that occupation law applies as a matter of law, not fact, and Israel is actually an occupying power, but has failed to implement its own interpretation of law for 2 reasons. One is, in the aftermath of the 1967 war, The Johnson administration determined the value of Israel as a Cold War asset in the Middle East as it vied with the Soviet Union to fill the power vacuum left by the European colonial powers. In that struggle to fill the power vacuum, what it decided and inaugurated after 1967 was a policy of ensuring Israel's qualitative military edge over any single one of its neighbors or collection of its neighbors so that it could prevail in a military confrontation should it arise. That's policy one. Before that, the United States had maintained a stalemate policy of equally arming Israel and its Arab monarchical regimes. So qualitative military edge. The second policy that it inaugurates, and this is another piece of this framework of why this sui generis occupation works, is that the Johnson administration also inaugurates and helps to orchestrate the Land for Peace framework, which is enshrined in UN Security Council Resolution 242. At the time that Israel occupies these territories, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, the UN is in session and is in agreement that Israel is an occupying power and should withdraw. If, in fact, its attack on Egypt's air force, which had lain barren in the Sinai Peninsula and which was destroyed in 2 hours, if that initial attack was unprompted, then Israel has committed aggression, which is a use of force that is illegal and therefore has the legal obligation to withdraw without preconditions. If instead that was a preemptive use of force or self-defense, then Israel has the right to remain as an occupying power, but under no circumstances to assert title or territorial conquest. Why does this matter? In the drafting of the Security Council resolution, Johnson personally himself wanted to ensure that Israel can maintain the territories as consideration in exchange with the Arab states for permanent peace, as part of a contractual agreement. Johnson was senator during Eisenhower's administration when Eisenhower forced Israel, France, and the UK to withdraw from the Suez Canal. And Johnson thought at the time Israel should have been allowed to maintain the Egyptian territory and hold on to it until Egypt agreed to normalize its relationship with it and to establish a permanent peace. Here in 1967, the opportunity arose again. And rather than apply international law and withdrawal as a legal obligation, instead it becomes reformulated as a political equation of a quid pro quo exchange of land when you give us peace. In the negotiations, there was disagreement. Israel wanted to keep it. So there was disagreement about which territories were to be withdrawn from. And the debate then raged about the terms of withdrawal, of immediacy, what would come first, withdrawal or peace. There was one other piece of the debate, which was the armistice lines as being tenuous and not being the permanent lines. The Johnson administration, as well as the UK, urged that the definite article, the, be dropped from the resolution in order to permit negotiation on the permanent borders, but never, ever to actually change the territorial integrity. And so here is one. There were 5 draft resolutions at the time. This is the Latin American bloc resolution. You could see in every other draft resolution, besides the one that's ultimately presented by the United Kingdom that becomes the language of 242, the definite article, the, all the territories, is included. The US votes for this, by the way. It doesn't pass because there's disagreement about the sequence of withdrawal or peace. This is the final resolution. This is actually 242. You'll see that the definite article is dropped. But in the preambular text, there's the prohibition on the acquisition of territory by war. In the actual clause itself, it's stipulated that it was occupied in recent conflict. We know that legal loopholes are coming. And state after state, including France, argue that this is to be understood as allowing for minor border modifications. But Abba Iban, who represents Israel to the UN during this time and is quite exceptional in his skills, explains very forthrightly The resolution means what it says and does not mean what it does not say. Another legalese that becomes consequential to this present day, together with Israel's own logic of what it would need to establish permanent borders, this one articulated by Deputy Prime Minister Igal Alon, who argues that defensible borders would be tantamount to this. As you could see, all of the orange is what Israel defines as what its defensible borders would look like and what would be necessary for security purposes. Jerusalem is part of that plan. There is continuity between the interior of Israel as well as its border with Jordan. It controls almost the entirety of the eastern border. This is what it wanted, articulated in 1967. It is achieved far more than that. It is achieved far more than that into the present. So let me just also add here that this could not be possible to the present without Palestinian participation and acquiescence, as embodied and represented through the peace process that's inaugurated in 1993. The Oslo Accords themselves, Dr. Tilley referred that we should compare them to apartheid plans. I would urge you to compare them to the 1978 Middle East peace process framework established by Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin that articulates a framework of autonomy without sovereignty. And it is verbatim a replication of that document that never envisioned a state. A state was never part of the negotiations. And this outcome is not because the law didn't work. It's because the law has worked perfectly well and very effectively that we have this outcome. How does that work? So here are the three parts. Israel is claiming that it is a sui generis occupation, therefore it has no legal obligation to apply occupation law, including the prescription on civilian settlement and captured or encapsulated by Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, also tantamount to a war crime. And under their presence, they can both take the land under military necessity and remain there under the legal fiction of temporality. Then, why can they change the borders and not maintain the 1967 border? Because under Security Council 242, the resolution says withdraw from territories, but doesn't specify from which territories, because of the lack of the definite preposition. And three, this would have totally failed as a legal argument because it does not withstand any judicial scrutiny and has been rejected by the International Court of Justice, by the International Criminal Court, by the UN Security Council, as we've seen most recently in UN Security Council 2334, as well as by multiple human rights organizations, but nevertheless remains valid as a legal argument because of the third prong, which is the U.S. provision of political immunity and support, despite its own policy imperatives, because it doesn't want to apply sanctions on Israel because that would diminish its qualitative military edge, and it doesn't want to apply international law as a matter of that would dictate the outcome because that would actually diminish Israel's negotiating hand in negotiations. And so those three parts together, reinforcing, create this outcome today where Israel has taken the land but not taken the people and has enabled it to remove the Palestinians, to concentrate them, and to dispossess them onto these plots of land. This scenario that we see in the West Bank very vividly also exists in the Gaza Strip, but even there, it's a very large concentration, and it too has been reduced in size the last time in 2014 by expanding the buffer zone by 40%. And if I had the map, which I do not, of Israel proper, we can see the concentration of Palestinians. Similarly, I think it was the first zone that Dr. Tilley pointed out to you, both in the Galilee region, which is the highest concentration of Palestinian citizens of Israel or natives, essentially, as well as in the Negev. The concentration of Palestinians in the Negev is what is driving Israel today to remove those Palestinians forcefully, approximately 70,000 Palestinians, to place them into, concentrate them into urban townships, remove from their agricultural livelihoods, and to build a settlement, an Israeli settlement within Israel in their place in order to disrupt their ability to return or have a claim of that return, fully fitting within a settler colonial framework, which is what we are marching pushing towards. And in fact, by defunding UNRWA, what we're doing is diminishing one. The idea is to make them indistinct from the rest of the Arab population so that they can be absorbed elsewhere in surrounding countries and therefore further diminish the demographic threat, so to speak, and further the idea of establishing Israel's Jewish settler sovereignty to be uncontested. That settler sovereignty to this day remains contested because of the demographic balance. And within Israel, it remains an active frontier. There are other settler colonies in the world. Israel is not unique for this. The United States is a settler colony. What we see going on in the Dakota Access Pipeline is actually the removal of natives and taking away of their lands and obscuring the fact that they exist as a people and perpetuating a myth that the natives have disappeared in very similar ways that we perpetuate the myth of disappearance of Palestinians and their indistinct nationality with surrounding Arab countries. Thank you.
That was Noor Arakat, noted Palestinian legal scholar, human rights attorney, and activist. She's an assistant professor at George Mason University and was one of the speakers at the annual conference organized by the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. She spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on March 2, 2018. Prior to joining the George Mason faculty, Noor Arakat served as a legal counsel for a House subcommittee and as the national grassroots organizer and legal advocate at the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, now the U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights. She's also the producer of a short video, Black Palestinian Solidarity. Videos and transcripts of the conference can be found via the website of IRMAP, short for Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. The brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.